I have alluded before, I think, to an incident out of the life of Sir Christopher Wren, the great architect who had so much to do with the rebuilding of the City of London after the Great Fire of 1666. His most ambitious undertaking was the building of St. Paul's Cathedral. It took 35 long years to complete this task, and when it was finally done, Sir Christopher himself escorted through the edifice the then reigning monarch, Her Majesty Queen Anne. He showed her every part of it, and then awaited breathlessly for her reaction to this into which he has poured so much of his life. Her reaction was summed up in three words. She said it was awful, it was amusing, and it was artificial. Can you imagine 35 years of your life and that be the word summed up for what you had done? However, according to the biographer Sir Christopher, on hearing these words, he heaved a great sigh of relief and bowed gratefully before his sovereign. Now, how on earth could he do that? Well, the answer is a linguistic one. You need to know that back in 1710, when this was transpiring, the word awful meant awe-inspiring. The word amusing meant amazing, and the word artificial meant artistic. You realize then that words are a living, dynamic thing. They change their meaning from time to time and from age to age, which is why we have to continue retranslating the scriptures. We have to continue updating our books of common prayer. Words do not stay the same any more than anything in history. And that is very important that you understand this morning as you look at the title of the sermon. Last Monday in the office, I said that I wanted to preach today on the subject, God is an amateur. And believe me, eyebrows began to go up all over the place. Nobody said it in so many words, but I could tell what they were thinking, either what's happened, has he fallen out of his tree, or is he desperate to get up a crowd for Labor Day Sunday and therefore is trying to be cutesy with the title? Therefore, I was very quick to say to them that the same thing that happened to the words awful, artificial, and amusing has also happened to the word amateur. You need to know that it comes from a Latin root originally, amour, that means to love. And an amateur in the original sense was a person who did something for the love of it. They were not paid to do it, they were not forced to do it, they were not made to do it. They did it rather because it came out of the depths of their own being. I suppose that our contemporary term, intentionality, maybe would be the best way of putting descriptive understanding around the original meaning of amateur. The anonym originally would have been a slave, someone who was forced to do something against his will or her will. The amateur in the original sense was somebody who did something sheerly and totally for the love of it. Now, obviously, the word has shifted in its meaning in our own time. We use the term amateur to describe competence more than motivation. If somebody is an amateur in our culture, we mean by that they are usually awkward, not very well trained, do not have the skill of a professional. You see, professional is the antonym that we would set over against amateur today. Slave was the antonym that should have been set over against in the original usage. And I am speaking this morning back to that original sense. I'm not trying to suggest that God is an inept bumbler this morning when I say that God is an amateur. I'm rather going back to what that word meant in its original usage, namely one who does something for the love of it. For it occurs to me that when you see it in that light, this may be the best adjective we have for understanding the mystery of Godness and also catching a glimpse of our own humanness, who we are, and what it is that we are supposed to be doing with the strength and the potency of our lives. God is an amateur. That may be the clearest word that Holy Scripture gives us about the nameless wonder that stands behind it all. A few moments ago, as I was reading for you that great poem to creation, that magnificent word that is known to us as Genesis 1, did you sense behind it and all through it the reality for which the word amateur originally stood? Did not you sense that there wasn't the least bit of coercion or strain about the great process that was being described there? There was no power outside of God who put a gun to his head and said, make a world or else. There is nothing here that suggests that God was driven or forced to create the world for any other reason outside himself. If you listen to the nuances behind this great passage, it seems abundantly clear that the desire to create came straight out of the depths of God. It was something he wanted to do, not something he had to do. You get the feeling that he looked over all the options that were before him, all the things of which he was capable, that he freely picked that which was the most appealing, and because he had wisely chosen within the circle of his capabilities, he was thereby able to act with dispatch and with effectiveness. There is no sense that God has gotten himself into something that he can't get out of. There is that majestic let us, and it comes about as God intended for it to be. And then seven times in the passage, did you hear it? Seven times there was that incredible refrain, and God looked at what he had made, and behold, it was good. Here is God wisely deciding what he wants to do, carrying through on that resolve. And when he looks back, he is pleased that he chose to do it. He is delighted with what has come of it. I suggest to you that there is behind this whole magnificent passage the incredible affirmation that God is an amateur. He did what he did for the love of it. The explanation is not to be found anywhere outside him. It is to be found only within that which he wanted to do out of his own intentionality. And to know this about God is to know one of the most important single facts about our existence. For one thing, it says to the question, why something and not nothing? Where did everything come from and why is anything here? It gives you an abundantly positive answer by saying, God must have found his own aliveness to be so joyful that he decided one day that he wanted to let others in on it. This is too good to keep. This is something that I would like to share on a wider basis. Therefore, creation is an act of generosity, not an act of selfishness. There is no sense in this passage that God needed to create the world out of some kind of emptiness, that he had some kind of need that caused him in a compulsive way to act in this particular form. There is a sense in which everything is profoundly unnecessary to this all-sufficient joy, and therefore everything comes out of his desire to give. Nothing comes out of an anxiousness or a strain. And to know that joy is where we came from and joy is what we are intended for, to know that creation is here not in order to get something for God, but to give something of God, to sense that bottomless kind of joy that wanted to give itself. If you ever begin to feel your own existence, the existence of other things, with that kind of positive sheen, it can make a difference in the spirit with which you view all things and with which you do your life. I also think that sensing that God is an amateur, recognizing that everything is because he wanted it to be and not because it had to be, can also give you a clue as to why God has related as he has across the centuries to our particular planet. It seems like to me that there is no other explanation for the mercy and patience of God outside this incredible affirmation, he must be an amateur. That is, if God had some kind of desperate need bound up in our creation, if he was having to justify part of himself by virtue of what we became, believe you me, he would have either long ago invaded this earth with power and regimented us according to his purpose, or he would have given up long ago in disgust and say, there is no hope for this kind of rebellious planet. The fact that God is still hanging in with his original creation, continuing to work with us in such mercy and patience, is to me a supreme clue that he must be an amateur. He must be in this because he wants to be. You could not pay God enough or coerce God enough to stay with our kind of planet if he had been in it for any other reason save his own delight and his own desire. Don't you know that there are some things that we simply won't do for any other reason except for love? Don't you know that there are some tasks that you cannot pay people to undertake or pay people to stay in? We will do things out of love that we will not do for any other motive. Ask any parent who is worthy of the name, why have you across the years believed all things, hoped all things, endured all things, borne all things, and still haven't given up? Why have you stayed in there with your rebellious child? And there may be many reasons, but at bottom it's not money. It's not some kind of external constraint. They are in it for the love of it. It's the only thing that holds you in some of the deep and dark places of our human existence. I had a friend several years ago who had two children. His wife was expecting a third child. She died in a very unusual kind of disease. As she was delivering the third child, the baby lived, but the mother died. And that young father found himself with three little children and no wife. And he was telling me as he began to work his way out that not only was he going to hire at least two people to do what that wife, mother had been doing before, that not only was he going to hire at least two people to do what she had done, but how, he said, can you ever pay somebody to be what that one was to me and to our children? You see, we can do things for love that we can never do for money or coercion. There is a motivation here that will keep us in and with something that nothing else can begin to touch. Ask any spouse who has faithfully stood by another through a dark and difficult situation, why did you do it? Why did you stick by the person? And it won't be money, it won't be constraint. It will be because at bottom they're an amateur. They are doing it for the love of it. Several years ago, I watched my mother-in-law tenderly and faithfully stand by my father-in-law in the 15 years of slow deterioration that is known as Parkinson's disease. If you know anything about it, you know that it debilitates the body, but it is not fatal. And the person loses increasing control of body and emotion. I watched Mrs. Foster for 15 years, sometimes get up as many as 20 times in the night to rub his legs that were having muscle spasms, to get him a drink of water, to do something because the night is such a fearful time for sick folk. And then when the sun would come up, he would at last in exhaustion go to sleep, and then she would have the work of the day to do. I saw her not free to go hardly anywhere herself, a virtual prisoner for 15 years, and I never heard her murmur a sound of complaint. I never heard her rise in anger against what it was that she was called to do by day and by night. Why was she doing that? Not for money. You could not have paid her to do it. She was doing it for the love of it. She was, in the classic sense of the word, an amateur, doing it because it was her choice, doing it because she had it in her power and was willing to do it, doing it because even though it was exceedingly painful, it really was what she wanted to do with the strength that she had been given. And when I think of what God has gone through with our planet, with what we have done to him in our resistance and rebellion, and then see that he is still hanging in there with us, it says to me, he has to be in this because he wants to be. Otherwise, he would have long ago blown up in anger, given down in despair. He would have either regimented us or given up on us. The fact that creation is still intact goes back to what I say is the single most significant insight into the mystery. God is an amateur. He's doing it because He loves to do it and wants to do it, and there is no other explanation for the mercy and the faithfulness that the choir sang about a few minutes ago. Therefore, to know that God is an amateur is an extraordinary insight into His nature. It is also a revealing clue into our nature as human beings, because we're made in the image of that kind of mystery. It is in His likeness that we have been called out of nothing into being. Can you hear me on this Labor Day Sunday when I say that amateur is our name as well as the name of God, that we are to do with our days and nights and with the strength that has been given us the same kind of joyous thing that God is doing with His strength? Have you ever thought of Genesis 1 as being about you as well as about God and creation? Have you ever thought in Genesis 1 that you have a paradigm of what a fully functioning human being ought to look like? Well, I want to suggest this morning that it is. Here is the clue of who we were meant to be, how we were meant to live our lives. Here you have the picture of what a human being at his best, her best, ought to be. And yet the minute I began to think that way and take the pattern of Genesis 1 and lay it alongside the way I use my days and my nights, a great sense of sadness comes over me. And the familiar words of St. Paul began to take on existential meaning. Lo, we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory. That's it, isn't it? We have fallen short of the glory that is contained in that term amateur. We are not living our lives the way that Genesis 1 describes God as living His life. And if you don't believe it, I ask you now to take any 7 days of your existence, this past week or some week past in your life, and lay alongside it the pattern that we have just been talking about in Genesis 1, and I ask you, how much correlation is there? That means very practically, at the outset of the week, do you really survey all of your options? Do you really get in touch with everything that you could do, everything that is possible? And then, having looked at all the options, carefully pick out the one that you most want to do, that lies at the dead center of your gifts and powers and desires. And then do you begin with vigor and with enthusiasm to throw yourself into it, to do with all of your heart and all of your mind that which you most want to do? And then when you get to Saturday night, do you look back and say, you know, this really has been a good week. I'm really glad I chose to do what I chose last Sunday. I'm really glad I've spent the energy as I have spent it. And the thing that has come of it, I really do feel like it's something that is very good. Is that the way most of your weeks unfold? If I was honest with you this morning, there has never been a week. There has never been a week when I have begun to live up to this kind of glory. There has never been a week when I have done with my life what Genesis says God does with His and meant for me to do with mine. The tragedy is that we have fallen short of the glory. We have lost our amateur status. Instead of my living as I have described, so often I rush into a week without really thinking through what the possibilities are. I get involved in this, and then I get involved with that. I am pushed here, there, and yonder. Before I know it, I'm into 10 times more than I can possibly do. I'm into things that mean something to somebody else but don't really have any appeal to me. I'm up to here, more irons in the fire than I can begin to number. And my Saturday nights, more often than not, are not characterized by delight, but they're characterized with disappointment and disgust. I see that little bits of life have gone here and there, and I have nothing to show for it. No sense of delight as I sense at the ending of God's first week. And I find myself asking, how have I gotten myself so far from where I was meant to be? Here I was born to be free, and I've turned out to be a galley slave. doing things because I have to, not because I want to, driven rather than drawn, involved in a lot of other people's agenda, but my own uniqueness having never been discovered and never been acted on. And I find myself asking, how has it happened? How have I lost my amateur status? And how have I gotten sold under this bondage of being busy but not being joyful, of being involved in so much but not really doing it for the love of it, but doing it for some reason because I have to? Well, I don't suppose that there is any single or simple answer how any of us get sold into slavery. As I analyze my own situation as to why I have gotten myself so far from the glory, I detect many clues. For one thing, I have to confess that early in life, I didn't do my homework. Unlike Columbus, I did not start out taking a voyage within to try to explore what kind of strengths and what kinds of capabilities were inside of me. I did not really look carefully at the particular cards that I had been dealt by the hand of creation. I didn't look there for what I can do and for what I can't do, for what I really want to do is over against what I don't want to do. And if you've ever played cards, you know that if you don't begin by picking up your hand, what hope is there that you're going to make very intelligent use of what you have or make much of the game? But I must confess to you that I didn't do my homework. I did not get in touch with what the book of Psalms calls all that is within me. I did not look to see what I had been given by the hand of creation. Why did I not do that? Well, as I've tried to analyze it, I find two old ancient foes. I find first that sense of self-despising that I have shared with you before has been my companion almost from the beginning. I have no idea where it came from. I cannot blame it on anybody. All I know is that from the first time that I began to be conscious of me, I had this sense of nobodiness. I had this feeling that I was a big fat zero, a nobody. I do remember that the word that was ground into me over and over again was, if you're ever going to amount to anything, John, you got to make something of yourself. And it was said with a kind of fearfulness and a kind of strain. And I know it could mean many things. What I translated it to mean was, as you are, John, you don't have any worth. You don't amount to anything. If there is worth, it is out there somewhere else, and you're going to have to go get it and import it. There is nothing in you as you are that can really be celebrated. And therefore, that old sense of nobodiness and emptiness propelled me into a life of strain and competition, of always trying to reach out and get something from somebody else to get it into my terrible sense of emptiness. I guess it's utterly predictable. If you don't think you have any worth, then there's no motivation to look within. Why should I have dug in this field if I'd already decided there was no treasure buried there? Why dip your bucket into a well if you think from the beginning that that well is utterly dry? What I'm saying is that my old, old sense of self-despising, if you're ever going to amount to anything, then you've got to become different than you are at this moment. That was one thing that kept me from doing my homework. The other thing was that old ancient foe called fear. Now, I didn't grow up in a church that even knew Sigmund Freud or read him by any stretch of the imagination. And yet the shadow of that Austrian psychiatrist who had worked at the beginning of this century evidently had filtered down to Nashville, Tennessee, because I remember getting the impression that if there wasn't anything good in me, there probably was a whole lot bad. That is, that the inside is where all of the brutal instincts have been placed. If you start roaming around in the basement, there's no telling what you're going to run into. I hadn't had anything said to me about sexuality, but the very silence made me feel there is something so terrible and awful down there that you can't even bear to bring it up in polite society. I think I had the feeling that the basement was where brutality and all kinds of lust were to be found. And you better let sleeping dogs lie. You better look the other way. You better not talk. You better not get in touch. And so the feeling that there wasn't anything good in me, and the feeling that there may be all kinds of bad things if I stirred them up, caused me not to do my homework, to never really ask, what kind of strengths do you have? What would you really like to do? No, I was a sitting duck to be manipulated by other people. I was in a position, since I thought all the value was out there, to make myself vulnerable to everybody else who came along. And anybody who's got their own act together, has their own agenda, can take somebody like me who doesn't know themselves and get them involved in all kinds of activity. My wife and I have a friend in Washington who makes a distinction between clear and unclear people. And she says an unclear person is no match for a clear person. Here is somebody who knows what they want, they know how to go after it. And here is somebody else who does not know themselves, is murky and confused and ambiguous, and this kind of person knows how to manipulate this kind of person and get this one into all kinds of activity. And that's exactly what happened to me. By the time I was 30 years old, I was working 18 hours a day. I was moving fast, but I was simply like a puppet on a thousand strings. I wasn't doing things that I was invested in. I was doing things that other people wanted me to do, things that I wanted people to like me for doing, and so I sold them part of my being. I was living not in the institution of slavery, but I was living under the control of forces beyond myself. And I think that I'm not alone this morning. If you have any sense of what it's like never to do what you want to do, but always find yourself being driven by what somebody else wants you to do, involved in a thousand things that have other people's name on them, but never invested really in something that comes out of the depths of your own uniqueness. That is psychic slavery. That is being under bondage. And nothing much changed in my life until I was 35 years old. And as I have told you again and again, the most important single thing that ever happened to me began to occur. Thomas Merton gave me a new word for it this summer, the breakthrough to the already. The way it happened to me, as most of you will remember, is that I got myself or found myself included in a group, ecumenical group of ministers in Louisville, Kentucky, convened by a courageous Presbyterian who, like me, had been spending himself in everybody else's causes, who didn't really feel he had any worth or didn't have any potency he could call his own. He was exhausted. He reached out saying, I've got to have help or else. A few of us gathered around, and to my incredible amazement, I found that the difference in us is a matter of degree and not of kind, that what I was doing was what they were doing, that my kind of self-despising was not stranger to them. Unamuno is so right. If we ever got honest enough to go out in the streets and uncover our common griefs, what we would discover is that we're all grieving for the self-same thing. We're so much alike. And I found there around that table that others like myself were not free. Lots of busyness, but no real amateurism in the original sense. And one morning I got up the courage and the trust to take off my mask that I had been wearing so long, pretending that this is who I was, when underneath there were so many scars. And I took off my mask and I told my story and I wept my tears and I let it all hang out, as they say. And it was the Episcopal minister, man with whom I felt very little native affinity, who said to me, John, I hear you. Oh, I hear you, because I'm there too. Do you know what we need? Not what you need. Do you know what we need? God, we need to hear the gospel in our guts. And then he said over there in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, ye are the light of the world. He doesn't say you got to be number one to get light. out-achieve everybody else in order to earn light. He says, man, you simply are light. He said, if we could ever hear that in our guts, really hear it and believe it, then we could do what Jesus said. Then we could let our light shine and people could see the good thing that God has made and begin to give glory to the Father in heaven. I don't know why I'd never heard it. God knows I'd read it often enough, even in the original Greek. I don't know why I hadn't heard it. All I can say is that in that moment, something like fire moved from the top of my head to the bottom of my heart. And 35 years old and a minister of the gospel, I recognized for the first time that morning that there really was worth inside of me, not by virtue of what I had made of myself, but by virtue of what God had made of me. There really was something in there good, and I had never recognized it, had never been aware of it, had never known of it. And that morning was the beginning of my glimpsing the glory that I had been talking about today. That was the beginning of the courage to begin to do homework. You're really behind if you're 35 and have never really worked with that which is within you, but that's where I was. And I don't mean to say that it was easy from that moment forward. It was not. It is not. I still have trouble with clear people who know what they want me to do, and I'm a means to their end. I still feel guilty when I say no, as the book title puts it. I still have trouble not letting other people take me over and get me to doing 1,000 things that are good, but they are not mine to do. I still struggle, but I'm here this morning to say that I have tasted how another kind of glory can be. I have sensed that there is in me potency and particular gifts. There are things that God wants to birth out of my depths that are uniquely mine to give. And if I have the courage to come in touch with that which is most uniquely mine, survey all the options, and then get in touch with that which has my name on it, and then begin to do that for the love of it, then occasionally there comes a Saturday night when I can look back on what I've done, and Genesis 1 begins to happen all over again, and I too find myself saying, hey, it really has been good. I'm glad I chose it, I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad I've gotten what I've gotten out of it. And those times are rare, but they are beginning to grow. And I say to you that this is the destiny that every one of us have from the moment that we were called out of nothing. Amateur is your name too. We were not born to be slaves. We were born to be the kind of free creative spirits that our great Father in the sky has always been. Which brings me back to where it all started. Words, like all things historical, have a way of shifting, changing their meaning. If you read the title of the sermon this morning, you probably said, what on earth, a typographical error? Is he going to stand up there and say that God is a bumbler? No. I got to go back to how that word got its start. Amour, love. An amateur is the person who does what he, she does for the love of it. And I've dared to say to you this morning that that's the clearest vision I think we have of God, and the best clue I know of who we are and what we're supposed to do. But isn't it true? Isn't it true? We have sinned, and we have fallen short of that great glory. But we don't have to go on that way. There is still time. There is still mercy. Amateur status is still available for everybody. Didn't he say he had come to set the captive free? Didn't he say that he had come to proclaim the great day of the Lord's deliverance? If you have seen this morning how far short of the glory you have fallen, maybe that's the first step toward realizing that you too are the light of the world. You too have in you that which God has placed that he wants to get out. You too can still be an amateur. Well. We speak to you now, many of us, from a dungeon. We're into 411 things, none of them our highest joy. O you who do understand and who dost still love, hear us when we say that we have sinned and we don't blame anybody else. We have fallen short of the glory. But, oh God, we don't want to stay here. We hear Christ coming, and we hear him singing the song, free at last, thank God Almighty, free at last. And he promises to teach us to sing it too. How good of Christ to do this. How good of you to still have hope. Save us. Save us. Liberate us. Many, many thanks. Amen.